From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. What's the best play you've seen this year? Or the best movie? No matter what you choose, chances are pretty good it was either by William Shakespeare or grew from his influence.
The plays themselves are living things. They grow and change over time, and they intersect powerfully with every generation that encounters them.
Shakespeare scholar Marjorie Garber says his ideas can be found everywhere in the theater, but also in the literature of politics, medicine, and the law. In fact, every generation has something to add to Shakespeare's legacy, and there are many out there who are trying to make sure the next generation has the opportunity as well.
If these children had access to classics and they had that sort of learning and understanding, would they still want to go out and vandalise a bus stop? Don't know. Would it make any difference that you'd read Shakespeare plays? Don't know. But it couldn't hurt, could it?
Shakespeare makes the leap from the black and white page not just to the world behind the curtain, but to the vivid pages of the graphic novel. Shakespeare for Our Time, coming up. Marjorie Garber has been writing about Shakespeare for years, earning a reputation as one of the world's premier Shakespeare scholars. And she's come to the conclusion that many of the things we think of as our own, the things that define our culture and who we are, were determined by a man who lived 400 years ago. In her new book, she argues that Shakespeare makes modern culture, and that modern culture makes Shakespeare. She gave Anne Strainchamp some examples.
Shakespeare has become for us the equivalent of a kind of modern public intellectual. We use taglines from Shakespearean phrases in headlines, in advertisements, as commentaries on the political scene, so that Shakespeare seems as a voice, almost disembodied from the plays, to be playing a part in the construction of modern culture.
But, you know, you think about other great playwrights in the English language, George Bernard Shaw or Shakespeare's contemporary Christopher Marlowe. They aren't cultural bywords in the way that Shakespeare is.
Well, that's true. But again, Marlowe wrote fewer plays. He died young and there was no immediate Marlowe industry. There really was a Shakespeare industry, starting with the First Folio in 1623, produced by members of his company, the Shakespeare Jubilee in the 18th century, where the great Shakespearean actor David Garrick, who was also a theater manager, produced a kind of a theme park day or several days in which people celebrated the person of Shakespeare. It's interesting, the Shakespeare Jubilee, because there was no production of a Shakespeare play there. So far as we can tell, there were no readings from the plays. There were anthems and theme songs and folk songs written about the plays. There was an ox roast and so forth. It really was a kind of Disneyfication before that concept of the idea of Shakespeare. And this would be one moment of beginning the idea that actually Shaw coined the term for, the idea of bardolatry, of the worship of the bard, of the worship of Shakespeare. So that Shakespeare has become a cultural commodity as well as a powerful playwright and literary voice.
Well, let's talk about some of the plays themselves. Romeo and Juliet, for instance, is one that everybody seems to know whether they've ever actually seen it or not. The most recent film version I'm thinking of was Shakespeare in Love, you know, that kind of play within a play about the writing of Romeo and Juliet. And In that one, there's the young Will Shakespeare sort of becomes Romeo himself, suggesting that besides loving the plays themselves, we've also now turned Shakespeare into a romantic hero.
Well, I think that's true of the script of Shakespeare in Love, which is a Tom Stoppard script and a Norman script and terrific in its own way. But Romeo and Juliet has become for our culture an anthem for youth culture in general.
Romeo, Romeo, a young man of Verona, a comedy by William Shakespeare.
My lady!
Who's that?
Will Shakespeare.
Anon, good nurse, anon. Master Shakespeare.
The same, alas.
Oh, but why alas?
A lowly player.
Alas, indeed. For I thought you the highest poet of my esteem and a writer of plays that capture my heart.
Oh, I am him too.
Madam? Anon. I will come again.
Oh, I am fortune's fool. I will be punished for this. My lady, my love.
If they find you here, they will kill you.
You can bring them with a word.
Oh, not
When I first started studying Shakespeare as a young person in school, the first play that I was taught was Julius Caesar, which was a historical play connected to the study of Latin that was going on in the next door classroom and so forth, and was not at all a romantic play or a play about love and sex and young people. It's very interesting that right now this is the play Romeo and Juliet, which introduces lots and lots of middle school readers or high school readers to Shakespeare.
Let's talk about some of the other plays and how characters have changed over time. Hamlet, for instance. Is our Hamlet very different from Shakespeare's?
Well, Shakespeare had many different Hamlets because there are many different versions of the play in Shakespeare's time. Only the first quarto of Shakespeare, what used to be called the bad quarto of Shakespeare that's now been rediscovered by actors as a great playing vehicle, doesn't include the soliloquies. And so the play moves much more quickly. And it doesn't have those great pauses for reflection, those great set pieces that think about consciousness and that have led some people to think of Hamlet as an originator of the idea of psychic interiority, of thinking of the man who thinks too much, the famous Olivier notion that this is a man who couldn't make up his mind. In fact, Hamlet makes up his mind quite a lot about a lot of things. But the early versions of the play didn't always stress the centrality of the thinking, dreaming Hamlet as opposed to the Hamlet of action. This is also true, really, of 20th century versions, that the Mel Gibson Hamlet is very different from the Olivier Hamlet, that different stagings of the play have tried to return Hamlet to his role as lover, to his role as political figure, to make him look more like Fortinbras and less like a philosopher detached from his time. Mm-hmm. Again, the play has gone through – Hamlet was such a favorite of the 19th century and became a play that was cited by lyric poets like Coleridge famously saying, "I have a smack of Hamlet myself if I do say so." And by that he meant that he was himself a procrastinator who had difficulty finishing projects. And Hamlet became a great favorite also of Goethe and of German writers. And the idea of Hamlet as basically a romantic figure in the notion of romanticism as well as of a dreaming figure, someone involved with creativity, with imagination, and not with the world of action. This became the Hamlet to a certain extent of the 19th century, and we have restored some of the more active elements of Hamlet in especially late 20th century productions.
That's interesting.
The Michael Almereyda Hamlet, the Hamlet that starred Ethan Hawke, actually, as a kind of slacker Hamlet set in a corporate culture, I thought was a terrific production and very much more a production about alienated youth coming back into action.
Rightly, to be great is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor is at the stake. How stand I, then, that have a father killed, a mother stained? Excitements of my reason and my blood, and let all sleep. From this time forth, my thoughts be bloody, or be nothing worth.
One of the more interesting things you found is how often Shakespeare appears now in contemporary business culture. It turns out Shakespeare is used to teach business and management principles to future CEOs.
Absolutely, to CEOs in leadership institutes all around the country and all around the world. There have been big spate of books called Shakespeare on Management or The Bard in the Boardroom or things like that, where Shakespeare's plays are used as case studies for executives and corporate figures to discuss things like decision making or how to fire somebody or how to assume command. And the play that has been a particular favorite, though they talk about Macbeth and Othello and Hamlet, but one of the great favorite plays, of course, has been Henry V, which is a play about an executive, in this case a king, a young man who sheds his wild background and becomes a powerful leader and has to make certain kinds of difficult decisions. There's one book that talks about Henry V deciding whether or not to hang an old friend for stealing something from a church. Well, this is a problem I hope that few business executives have to deal with. And these books have actually done quite well and been used as textbooks within business schools, but also, as I say, for summer institutes and for people returning for refresher courses. Instead of a case study from the social world, these are case studies from Shakespeare, another example of how Shakespeare and modern culture have come together.
You reprint a cartoon of Hillary Clinton as Lady Macbeth. Of course, she's probably not the only female politician to have been compared to Lady Macbeth.
Quite right. And Margaret Thatcher was compared to Lady Macbeth, and Nancy Pelosi was compared to Lady Macbeth, and indeed Condoleezza Rice was compared to Lady Macbeth. For a while there, Lady Macbeth was a kind of cultural macro for the powerful woman thought to be very ambitious. It's interesting, though, to see how dated, in a way, that cartoon of Hillary Clinton is, that now things have moved on, and her being in a newly powerful position has not spawned a new set of rather resentful cartoons about her getting above herself and being like Lady Macbeth.
Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood, stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctious visitings of nature shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it. Come to my woman's breasts and take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers. Wherever in your sightless substances you wait on nature's mischief. Come, thick night, and pall thee in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife see not the wound it makes, nor heaven peep through the blanket of the dark to cry, hold, hold.
For a while there, this was a way of cutting down to size women who had achieved something in the political realm, to call them Lady Macbeths and to suggest that somehow they were ambitious rather than effective. And I rather hope we've moved beyond that stereotype, but it was very powerful as a way of labeling independent women in the political sphere for quite a long time.
Are there other Shakespeare characters who've had a kind of rise and fall as cultural icons? Were there others in other ages, for instance?
Well, the figure of Falstaff was one of the earliest characters that got picked up as a separate character, with books being written about Falstaff, and where he seemed to, again, overwhelm the other characters in the Henry IV plays. And I think is less a figure for our time than he was for earlier times.
Now, why do you think that is? What was it about Falstaff that appealed so to an earlier age, and why does he not speak to us today?
Well, he himself at one moment in Henry IV allies himself with younger friends in the tavern and says, you know, they hate us youth, associating himself with young people. And I think this kind of attempting to recapture a lost youth or something, which looked very, you know, brave and amusing to a certain culture, now looks a little bit out of place. We're in a serious age now. We're in an age in which people evaluate their own responsibilities in various ways, feel that they need to pay attention to the economy and the war and their families and their social responsibilities and so forth. And so a character like Falstaff, who joyously abandons all of those commitments, has a certain kind of delicious theatrical power for us, but is less, I think, a model for a certain kind of standing apart from the everyday world.
So I'm curious, what do you yourself, as a Shakespeare scholar, somebody who's written many books about Shakespeare's plays, what do you make of Shakespeare's continued presence in our popular culture? I mean, does this seem a sad thing to you because you see Shakespeare being so diluted in our popular culture?
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Cause for celebration.
No, I think it's terrific. These popular cultural appropriations seem to me to be a very good thing. It means that Shakespeare is being mainstreamed. It means that we're thinking through the plays in various ways. The plays are very tough, resilient vehicles. No production, no citation of them can alter their essence except to make them more resonant for us. And again, one of the plays that I talk about in this connection is The Merchant of Venice, which after the Holocaust, after World War II, took on a cultural resonance, a certain set of extra-cultural meanings that were different from but very much in consonance with the power of the play beforehand. This is a play that has changed enormously over time from the early productions in which Shylock was a villain through his becoming a figure of pathetic sensibility, of real pathos around the turn of the 19th, 20th century. The play became a great vehicle for the Yiddish theater as well as for the English and American theaters, and indeed was produced in Nazi Germany as well as in America during the war. But the post-Holocaust view of The Merchant of Venice incorporates all of that history and suggests something both about the enormous resilience and power of the lines and the characters in the play and also about the way in which culture can continue to add to the power of a great literary vehicle like this. And that really is the argument of my whole book, that Shakespeare in popular culture, that Shakespeare in high culture, we really shouldn't make so many distinctions between those things. I think this is all our modern culture. And wherever we encounter Shakespeare, it enriches both Shakespeare and our own lives.
Let him look to his bond. He was wont to call me usurer. Let him look to his bond. He was wont to lend money for a Christian curse. Let him look to his bond.
Well, I'm sure if he forfeit, thou wilt not take his flesh. What's that good for?
To bait fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me half a million, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies. And what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? Why, revenge. The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction.
Marjorie Garber is a professor at Harvard University. She's written several books on Shakespeare, including most recently, On Shakespeare and Modern Culture. She talked with Anne Strainchamps. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Jess Winfield was one of the original instigators of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. He's brought that same mix of reverence and irreverence to his new novel, My Name is Will, a novel of sex, drugs, and Shakespeare. As with the movie Shakespeare in Love, Will himself does make an appearance in this novel. In fact, he's one of the main characters, but he is by no means the only Will Shakespeare on hand.
They both share a few significant traits, namely they're young and randy and trying to make a name for themselves in the world. Willie Shakespeare Greenberg trying to become the next William Shakespeare, is trying to write his thesis about the bard. William Shakespeare in 1582, would-be playwright, is stuck teaching Latin to six-year-olds in provincial backwater Stratford-upon-Avon. And both of them end up pursued by government agents, Willie Shakespeare Greenberg by Ronald Reagan's Drug Enforcement Agency, because he's trying to deliver a giant psilocybin mushroom to a mysterious dealer at a Renaissance fair, and the original William Shakespeare, because he's a dissident Catholic, part of an underground network, who has been asked to deliver a secret package from Rome to a mysterious friend.
Well, let's talk about that for a little bit, because that is something that could have been that Willie Shakespeare, the modern Willie Shakespeare Greenberg, the modern scholar, is interested in. In fact, this Catholic faith is not proven, but could be true, right?
Yeah, it is not proven, as almost anything about the bard's life isn't proven beyond what's in the historical record, which is very little. But some of the things that are in the historical record very much suggest that his family was Catholic. The Ardens, which is his family on his mother's side, were well-known Catholic dissidents. In fact, one of them was executed as a Catholic traitor under Queen Elizabeth's Catholic purges. His father, Mary Arden's son, there was a Catholic will that was found in the rafters of the house at Stratford-upon-Avon in the late 1800s, which disappeared but was authenticated by a couple of important scholars at the time. And Stratford in general was a very Catholic area of England. Most of the major luminaries of the town were Catholic, of which John Shakespeare, William's father, was one. He was the bailiff of Stratford during the time that Queen Elizabeth was putting the hammer down on local public officials.
I think in modern times we forget just how dangerous it would have been to be a Catholic in Elizabethan England. That was a no-no in very severe terms.
Indeed it was. And I mean, it was possible, I think, to be a Catholic and not say anything about it and be good and go to church. I think there was sort of a don't ask, don't tell policy at the time. But if you were at all public with your Catholic proclivities, and especially if you were supporting the Catholic Jesuit priests who had come over to sort of revive the religion from the continent, if you were supporting them or harboring them in any way, that was a big no-no and could get you hanged and drawn and quartered and other fun things like that.
Yeah, well, it would explain a lot about Shakespeare's understanding of tormented creatures as they appear in his plays, if in fact he was a Catholic, or at the very least a Catholic sympathizer.
I think so. I mean, whether Shakespeare himself was Catholic, there's no doubt that many of his friends and colleagues in Stratford were, that they were, you know, as I said, his members of his family were executed. The brother of his probable schoolmaster was tortured and executed. And even playwrights of his own day, Ben Jonson, Christopher Marlowe, you know, was murdered. Ben Jonson was tortured. And all of this was because of the sort of heated religious political unification that was going down at the time. My entire career has been one of trying to make Shakespeare accessible to modern audiences, whether it was with the Reduced Shakespeare Company or with this book. And, you know, one of the reasons that I paralleled the 1582 William Shakespeare story with a story of a more modern Willie Shakespeare was to try to give modern readers an angle, an entree into, you know, just what the political and emotional similarities are between young men of today and young men in 1582.
Well, of course, you refused to be serious about it entirely, too. Willie Shakespeare Greenberg, in discovering the Catholic coding of Will Shakespeare in Elizabethan days, if I remember correctly, does this while having sex with his advisor in the back of a bus.
Well, there has to be, like I said, we want to make him accessible. Some people have accused me of making him a little bit too accessible. But, you know, the subtitle of the book is My Name is Will, a novel of sex, drugs, and Shakespeare. And some people have been shocked to find out that there actually is sex in it when it's labeled quite clearly on the cover.
And actually, you go back and have some of the same things in William Shakespeare's day. And in fact, you above all would know the language of the plays, having spent all those years parodying it for the Reduced Shakespeare Company. The language of Shakespeare is, well, you can read it in many different ways, I guess, is one way to put it.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think, in fact, one of the reasons that I wanted the book to be sexy and bawdy is because the language of Elizabethan England is so bawdy at its core, and Shakespeare's plays are so full of sexual pun and innuendo. And, you know, writing about him at the time that I am, which is when he was 18 years old, you know, he was a young man like anybody else. We know that he was pulled into what was probably a shotgun wedding at the time. There was all sorts of sexual hijinks going on. And some of that sort of can get lost amid the, you know, the wonderful richness of the Shakespearean language. People have trouble accessing it. So I wanted to sort of bring that front and center. And what better way to do that than to slap them in the face with paralleling a young grad student having sex on a bus with William Shakespeare himself, you know, having sex with a bonny lass out in the fields of Stratford.
When you were coming up with chapters for this novel, For My Name Is Will, there are a number of places where the modern Willie Shakespeare quotes from the Elizabethan Shakespeare. You must have had fun finding ways to take the original text and spin it for a Reagan-era California.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, it wasn't as difficult as it seemed. In fact, when I first sat down to write, you know, it goes chapter by chapter, one chapter Willie Greenberg, one chapter William Shakespeare, one chapter Willie Greenberg. And when I sat down to write the first William Shakespeare 1582 chapter, I thought, my goodness, aren't you the cheeky one pretending to be able to write dialogue for William Shakespeare? And I actually sort of had a moment of panic when I was sitting at the keyboard. And then I sort of finally realized that, you know, William Shakespeare at 18 was just any other 18-year-old kid. He wasn't William Shakespeare, Bard of the Ages, the Swan of Stratford-upon-Avon yet. And if I could just get in touch with my inner screwed-up 18-year-old, which still isn't very far away from me, you know, that would be my access point. So really trying to parallel, you know, Shakespeare's life with Willie Greenberg's life isn't that difficult if you just think of them as young men trying to figure it all out.
Jess Winfield helped create the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and he's the author of My Name is Will, a novel of sex, drugs, and Shakespeare.
There are no manuscripts, there are no notes, there are no letters. There are no scratchings from his pen save for six signatures on legal documents prepared by other people. And people such as Henry James and Walt Whitman and Mark Twain have looked at that and they've said, you know, we've got the wrong guy.
There's a question about Shakespeare that's been asked so many times you would think we'd have a definitive answer. In fact, it's been answered over and over and over. What question? Was Shakespeare Shakespeare? And if he wasn't, who was he? Some say Christopher Marlowe. Others, Francis Bacon. Mark Anderson has another candidate in mind. He thinks the question needs to be asked again and considered carefully.
That is why this case and why this story is really about an accumulation of evidence, as you cannot look at any single piece of evidence and say, okay, well, that does it. That in and of itself proves it. As Orson Welles said, he said, I think the Earl of Oxford wrote Shakespeare. If you don't, there are some awful funny coincidences to explain away. So it is the accumulation of those awful funny coincidences that I think really makes the case for De Vere. I think that the most persuasive piece of evidence, if one can call it that, is just the hundreds and hundreds of connections between De Vere's life and the plays. Just pick two plays as an example, Hamlet and King Lear. Now, these plays are referring to original source texts, right? There's an ancient myth of Hamlet called Amleth, and there's an ancient chronicle legend of King Lear. So Shakespeare is drawing from these original sources, and in fact, Shakespeare seems to have been one of the most widely read authors of the period, referring to so many sources that even weren't available in English. But back to Hamlet and Lear, I mean, I think to me what's most interesting is, yes, so Shakespeare uses these sources, but he departs from them as well. It's not like he's just retelling the ancient chronicle history of Hamlet, the ancient Danish chronicle. Instead, what he's doing is he's beginning with these stories. The areas where he diverts from the sources are consistently in the direction towards greater resemblance toward De Vere's story. So, as an example.
Give me some examples.
Yeah, as an example, we'll look at Hamlet. Hamlet is, you know, it's a legend of a Danish prince from long, long ago. Well, okay, so on top of that story, you have a thread that is amplified a great deal, which is the story of this counselor at court, which Shakespeare calls Polonius, and he has a daughter named Ophelia. And Hamlet and Ophelia and Polonius have this, I mean, it's this very troubled relationship. Polonius is essentially the chief counselor of the Danish court, and Ophelia is kind of caught in the middle. And the degree to which these characters are really fleshed out, because there are characters that vaguely resemble them in the original source, but Shakespeare really makes them real and makes them whole. And these characters are, in fact, inspired by De Vere's father-in-law and his wife, his first wife. De Vere's father-in-law was the chief counselor of Queen Elizabeth's court, and his wife was, the poor dear, she was spied on continually by her father. And there's a scene in Hamlet where Polonius sends off spies to kind of pry in on his son's doings in Paris. Well, this is exactly what William Cecil did. When William Cecil's son was living in Paris, William sent spies off to go pry out the secrets of what his son is doing. So that's part of the story.
What about in King Lear then?
Okay, well, King Lear is again an ancient chronicle legend. It's a story of a man who is disinheriting himself to his children. Well, I think the reason that this play was adapted, I mean, why pick these sources? You know, why go to these obscure tales? Well, I think it's quite clear that, again, the sources themselves have a great deal of autobiographical meaning, and then on top of it, he adds new layers of autobiographical meaning. When De Vere was age 40, he was pretty destitute, and he ended up having to disinherit himself of his ancestral castle amongst his three daughters. So that's the central story of King Lear. But then you look at the stuff that Shakespeare adds on to King Lear. Shakespeare adds this extra plot line that's not in the original source of this guy named the Earl of Gloucester, who has a legitimate son named Edgar and a bastard son named Edmund. Now, that's the story of De Vere's second marriage. De Vere's second marriage, he had one son, and he had an illegitimate son by a mistress. That is De Vere's progeny. Three daughters, a legitimate son, and an illegitimate son. Precisely. I mean, it maps exactly to the parental and filial anxiety that is being staged so gloriously in King Lear.
So if Edward De Vere really did write these plays, why didn't he put them under his own name?
Well, Steve, I would say probably the best single word answer to that is politics. These plays are, as I said, they're very autobiographical, but unlike, you know, a writer like Tennessee Williams or Charles Dickens, the people that he is writing about, the people in his world, in De Vere's world, are some of the most powerful people in England, and they have their own political futures and their own political careers that are going quite well, thank you very much. And they don't need some loudmouth, you know, son-in-law or some loudmouth kid at court telling them or telling the world that they are spying on their family.
But on the other hand, the plays are not about characters in Shakespeare or De Vere's own time. I mean, they tend to be histories about people who had lived sometime earlier.
Yes, indeed. And so it is as Hamlet portrays. I mean, if you look in Hamlet, how does Hamlet present drama? Well, drama is the thing where we'll catch the conscience of the king. And what Hamlet does is he stages this ancient Italian legend of a murder that he thinks took place in the Danish court. Now, everyone watching that play at court knows that this play, The Mousetrap, has nothing to do with something a long time ago and, you know, off in Italy. It's about contemporary politics. It's about what happened right here. The king of Denmark killed my father, says Hamlet, and he says it on stage. That's what De Vere is doing. De Vere is doing this consistently, although he's not necessarily accusing people of murder all the time, but he is portraying, for instance, Queen Elizabeth. De Vere was raised from age 12 onwards as the ward of state. His father died under, well, one might say somewhat mysterious circumstances, but we'll let that one rest. But once he was brought to the court, he was raised as a ward of Queen Elizabeth and more directly a ward of this man, William Cecil, who became eventually his father-in-law. De Vere married this guy's daughter. And so Queen Elizabeth was his stepmother figure at court. But at the same time, by the age of 23, De Vere was said to have had a love affair with Queen Elizabeth. Now think about that twisted kind of Oedipal relationship between Hamlet and the Queen of Denmark. And that's the kind of conflicts and the kind of emotional drama that is going on in De Vere's life.
Isn't it possible that William Shakespeare, the actor, knew De Vere? Suppose that Shakespeare was the guy who really did write the plays. Maybe he just knew enough about De Vere's life to be able to crib all these details from
it. Or there's a play that just was recently released called The Beard of Avon by this playwright named Amy Fried. She's a professor of drama at Stanford. And she supposes that the works are actually a collaboration between De Vere and Shakespeare of Stratford. And so, you know, as you can tell, the research and the perspectives on this are wide open, and lots of people are investing time and effort to really get to the bottom of this, and I think it's just a fascinating mystery. But ultimately, De Vere is right at the center of the story, and that's the fascinating mystery of it all.
Mark Anderson's book is Shakespeare by Another Name: The Life of Edward De Vere, Earl of Oxford, The Man Who Was Shakespeare. He talked with Steve Paulson. But we can't just leave it there. We had another great modern Shakespeare scholar in our studios, Stephen Greenblatt, the man whose biography of Shakespeare, Will in the World, was on the New York Times bestseller list for weeks. So Steve thought he'd check in with him about this claim that there is no written evidence that Shakespeare was Shakespeare.
Depends what you mean by written evidence. There's plenty of written evidence in the sense that Shakespeare was celebrated in his lifetime as the author of his plays and poems, that his name is repeatedly used on title pages in order to sell plays when they were marketed in Shakespeare's lifetime, that 7 years after Shakespeare died, a huge edition of his works came out with his picture on it and dedicatory letters from a large number of people who knew him personally, starting with Ben Jonson, but many other people.
Weren't there also some people, or wasn't there speculation that someone else had written the plays, even in Shakespeare's lifetime?
No, none. The speculation that someone else had written the plays is a 19th century phenomenon. And it's an interesting phenomenon, and its longevity is an interesting phenomenon, the fact that people keep coming back to this question now. But it's a very, very late moment, comes hundreds of years. No one in Shakespeare's lifetime ever raised a hint of the thought that someone else might have written the plays. It's true that Shakespeare, because of his modest background, the son of a middle-class glover from Stratford, Shakespeare flies under the radar of interest of a biographical kind at the time. And that would be true of almost any writer of that class. You'd have to have come from a much different social class as, let's say, Sir Philip Sidney, from an aristocratic background, to get people interested in your life as such. No one was interested in the life of the son of a Stratford glover.
Even though he became a very prominent playwright.
Yeah, but it just wasn't part of the... That's an interesting phenomenon, but it's a larger sociological phenomenon. People didn't think that people from that class deserved, as it were, biographical attention.
Hmm.
But it's also the case that... More tellingly, or more for the point of view of those people who want to challenge Shakespearean authorship, no manuscripts survive of the play, so we can't verify anything that way. The only manuscript is the manuscript of this play written by multiple hands, Sir Thomas More, that was not performed. And then, I think very interestingly, in his last will and testament, Shakespeare's last will and testament, which does survive, there is no mention of his rights to the theater, his partial ownership of the theater or any other aspect of the theatrical world that he was part of.
But there is mention of other things. I mean, he's very specific about leaving, pens to actor friends and a silver bowl to someone, a bed. I mean, there are these various things, but it has no reference to his work in the theater, which seems odd.
Yes, it is odd. The reference to the theater, I mean, it comes in the sense of he refers to people like John Hemmings, who was a fellow actor of his. In other words, we know from many, many other documents that survive in the period that William Shakespeare was a member of the company, and that's confirmed, as it were, that way by the last will and testament. But he doesn't leave, for example, he doesn't bequeath his share in the acting company to his fellows, and he doesn't bequeath books to his daughter, Susanna, for example. There's no specific mention of a library. He must have owned
books. Lots of books.
Well, maybe not lots, but some. I mean,
he was a tremendously learned man.
Yeah, he could have read it at his friend Nathan Field, the printer, but he must have owned books. He was a wealthy man as well. So what can we conclude from that? One thing is people have collected now lots of wills from the period, playhouse wills, they call them, and this is not so anomalous. There are lots of people who dispose of that aspect of their wealth in different ways, partly to avoid what we would call probate, but the equivalent of that, which in Shakespeare's case, I think, was largely to avoid his wife Anne's getting very much of it.
So, but you don't think there was a larger concerted effort by Shakespeare to sort of keep his name off of document, off of written plays? I mean, it is striking that there are no manuscripts left. I mean, what eventually became the plays?
Certainly no concerted effort to keep his name off plays. His name appears on many plays as the author of many
but
plays.
But in terms of the actual, I mean, finding his written pen, I mean, yes. It's just you almost can't find it anymore.
Yeah, paper is expensive. My sense is that there's two answers to this question, I think. One is that no one thought of these things as very valuable or as having any value at all. I think they thought of them as probably having more value to wrap things or to burn in a fire on a cold night. But the other thing is I think Shakespeare was quite cautious about his name. I think that he was determined and was extremely good at staying out of jail, which is not so easy if you led a public life as a writer.
Now, the Shakespeare doubters have put forward an alternative person who might have written these plays, Edward de Vere, an aristocrat who, I mean, if you do look at some of the circumstances in his life, they seem to parallel a lot of what happens in the plays. He lived in Italy for extended periods, and Shakespeare set a number of his plays, especially in Venice, which de Vere knew very well. How do you respond to that line of argument?
Well, the great thing about Edward de Vere is that he's someone who went to university and is of the right social class, because behind a lot of this desire, at least from the 19th century on, maybe it's faded slightly, but was the almost desperate embarrassment at having a middle-class person, Glover's son, wool merchant's son, who didn't go to university. So neither university nor the right social class be England's national poet. So if you believe that you have to be of the right social class and you believe that you need a university degree, which in Shakespeare's time meant largely a degree in theology, if you think that those things are requirements for being a great artist, playwright, then you frantically look around for someone else who might have been the real William Shakespeare. And de Vere is a perfectly good candidate for that. I happen not to think that a university degree or the right social class are requirements for being a great artist. Do you? I mean, is this actually something that we think is needed? The imagination is ours. It's universal. That's why Shakespeare, who had an unusual, absolutely astonishing command of this, but that's why Shakespeare is now what he is for all of us, because he knows how to tap into something that's our possession. You don't have to go to university for this. You don't have to have the right background. You have it in your head already. And he knew how to get that more than any artist in the modern world. He knew how to tap into what we all possess democratically. And I think that is the continuing and enduring power of this work.
Stephen Greenblatt is the author of Will in the World, among many other works. He talked with Steve Paulson. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Half the fun of discussing Shakespeare comes from watching the ways people take the original and change it. But how do you get to the original in the first place? By waiting for your high school English teacher to force march you through Julius Caesar once again? But what if you could have found Shakespeare on your own? Or been attracted to these stories the way you were to other adventures? The language can be daunting, yes, but what if, well, what if you could both be true to the language and mess with it a little? The folks at Classical Comics have done that and more, publishing graphic novel versions of Macbeth and Henry V that are visually compelling. And what's more, as Karen Winborn of Classical Comics told me, they decided it made sense to provide three versions for a new generation of readers.
Children, the PlayStation generation, were demanding bright modern graphics, vivid colours, and constant action. Very, very short attention spans. And even things that I considered relatively modern in terms of graphics, my son would say, oh, Mum, that's just so ancient. So it had to be full colour and it had to be really lively. So bringing superheroes into classics, which is how certainly the first two books, Henry and Macbeth, were born.
I somewhere saw that your colleague, Clive Bryant, was quoted as saying, we want to make Shakespeare as energetic and colourful as Spider-Man. That's not something most English literature scholars are likely to say, is it?
There are a lot of comments about, you know, Will Shakespeare and the hallowed bard. And he was a man who was writing for the people. He was writing to make money. He wanted to entertain. He'd probably think it quite amusing to see the way we've put him on a pedestal and, you know, judge him as something so completely different. If he was alive today, I am convinced he would have had his plays made into animated films and graphic novels way before we thought of the idea.
Now, in fact, for these, you hired artists who have worked on the Spider-Man comics, didn't you?
Yeah, John Howard was the Spider-Man artist he'd drawn for Panini. Yes, he had.
So it gives you some sense of, for those who haven't seen them yet, what the artwork is like.
Oh, yeah, the witches are very Green Goblin-esque.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at the front of the quick text version of the Macbeth that you released, and they are vivid, to say the least. In fact, referring to the quick text makes me want to ask you about the way you decided to do this, because you've put out three versions of each of the plays. I have to tell you, I sort of thought of Kentucky Fried. You have the original and the extra crispy here.
We have the original text, which is the full and unabridged play. The plain text, which is unabridged, but it's in modern English. And then the quick text, which is both abridged and in modern English. But the artwork isn't changed throughout the different books. So the full story is always there in pictures.
Now, in the original text, you did literally use the full text of the original play?
Oh, yes. Nothing taken out at all. That's Will. It's an amalgam of Will, because there are a number of different versions, as you know, folio, quarto, and, you know, which version do you choose? And every purist has their choice, and ours is a bit of an amalgam. But then, as Will didn't leave us any, you know, this is the final version scripts, but it is a full version of the play, absolutely. Yeah.
So what's different in the plain text version? This is, as you said, still a full version, but you're taking some liberties with Shakespeare's language.
Yes, we put it into modern English. So the really famous speeches, once more into the breach in the case of Henry, happy band of brothers, a dagger which I see before me, knife, where did that come from, are all in the plain text too. So reading that, they still get Shakespeare's language on the remembered pieces, but the rest of it is in modern English. Because one of the main problems children and adults were having was accessibility. They'd pick the book up and say, oh, looks okay, oh, no, that's difficult, I'm having to translate.
Yeah.
So we translated it for them.
There is, as you say, in the classic speeches, very little change, but there are others. And it seems, I'm sure, to scholars as though the beauty is missing. I was looking at Macbeth specifically, which is a beautiful presentation of the play. And in the very beginning, the witches are chanting and it's identical. But then the report from the field comes in, and in the original it says, I think, doubtful it stood as two spent swimmers that do cling together and choke their art. And that becomes, by the time you get to the next one, it was poised on a knife edge. Both armies were exhausted and deadlocked. Yes, it's more straightforward, but who made these decisions?
We have a professional author and scriptwriter and scholar who produced the original text, still had to be scripted into comic book format. So the frames had to be broken down and art direction given. And it's as direct a translation as we can get. Given that Shakespeare invented so many words and phrases that therefore don't have an awful lot of options in a thesaurus, it is the straightest translation we can get.
Yeah.
Because the language is undoubtedly beautiful. If you don't understand the story, the language means very little to you. And we wanted people to be able to understand the story first. And when children will then say, wow, I read this, it's fantastic. And I say, that's Shakespeare. And they go, Yeah, whatever. Have you seen this fantastic story? And then they can go on to learn to love the language. Yeah. But if they're turned off at the first stage, like people say, oh, yes, we had to do Shakespeare at school. Oh, God, I still remember that. We want them to come away saying, hey, did you know what happened in Henry V? And, and because we produced the three versions, I think we've made it accessible to absolutely everybody. So the purists have got their book they can go straight to, and 10-year-olds can start with a quick text.
In fact, in this same scene where it starts with the two spent swimmers in Shakespeare's original, by the time you get to the quick text, it just says the battle was in the balance. A first-time reader, I suppose, that's what they want, and they want to go on to see what happens next.
Yes, they do. But the artwork does show the full story. So you will see an exhausted captain telling the story, and you'll know who he is because the characters are listed in the front of the book. So they can see as well as read. Yeah. People learn in very, very different ways too, and for a lot of them, the visual aspect is as great as the literature. Yeah. And for some people, Shakespeare in its original format is never going to be accessible. We've got to face that. You know, some people will never get there. But at least they've got access to the stories now. But there are a lot of debates in England over teaching of Shakespeare anyway, so that's an ongoing one for us.
When young people, I mean, you've had these out for a while now in other parts of the world, they're just coming to America. When young people come to the quick text, the most stripped down version of Macbeth, is it your experience that they progress then and are likely to pick up the plain or the original text?
That's a really interesting point, because the children who've voluntarily taken away quick text, when the next books have arrived, have said, can I have the plain text version this time? I think I'll try that. They're only a few months older, so it's not an age difference thing. And they're already asking for the harder version, if you like, which is brilliant. Oh, no, I'll have the one with the more words in this time. I think I can do that. Yeah. I think that's still a year or two away from, yes, I'll go for the original text. But then they'll know what Macbeth is all about. That's got to give them a head start. Yeah. And they'll also view it with, they'll be saying to their friends, hey, I read that, it was like a comic, it was a fantastic story, come on.
There are classical comics versions of Macbeth and Henry V currently available in the US. I talked with Karen Winborn. You can see the graphics and more on their website, which you can reach through ours at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a CD of this hour by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Shakespeare, Where There's a Will. It's number 315B. You can email us through our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced with me by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Claire Radomski. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.